If I said you're about to meet Richard Branson, how would you feel? Because you're about to meet the Richard Branson of the social sector. This man has made such a mark with his projects in Britain that he was ennobled. He's now a Lord. Lord Andrew Mawson sits on the crossbenches of the House of Lords at Westminster. It's less than 7 miles in a straight line from Bromley by Bow, where he began his work as a young church minister in 1984. 7 miles and a world away. Andrew Mawson is a social entrepreneur. He gets things to happen in communities. He was one of the first to wonder if the area of East London he works in could host the Olympics. That was more than a decade ago. Now he's using the building and investment the Olympics brings for social rejuvenation. He joins me now. Welcome to Life Matters.
Morning. Nice to see you.
You began your working life as an engineering apprentice and then went on to study for the ministry in Manchester. They're very different jobs.
Yeah.
What did you learn about life and work through doing those two things?
Well, as a telecommunications engineer, I did an apprenticeship, which meant you dug the roads, you did technology, you did planning, did a whole range of things, put telephones in people's houses, climbed telegraph posts. And you thought at that time you'd got a career for life, really. That was what it was like in those times. But, of course, what that did was gave me lots of very practical skills about how things work. You didn't realise it at the time, but actually, when eventually you become a clergyman, as I did, and landed in the East End of London with a sort of derelict church and 12 old people and £400 in the bank and nothing works, those sort of practical skills proved to be pretty useful, particularly if you're going to develop a more entrepreneurial approach. So I suppose the telecommunications industry thought I was going to use all those skills for them with 40 years, but by year five, you know, I'd moved out of that to read theology in Manchester.
And when you arrived to begin work at the church parish in Bromley by Bow, what was it like there?
It was a mess. I mean, I arrived one cold November evening to be greeted by a 200-seater run-down derelict church with 12 elderly people all over 70 sitting in this 200-seater church, sort of sitting where they'd always sat. And it looked as though the dead had been carried out and no one had noticed. And I was meant to stand in this pulpit and give words of wisdom to people who were three times my age. So it was all slightly crazy, really. Mm. And when I began to think about what assets we'd got, we'd literally got these derelict buildings, we'd got 12 elderly people, and we got £400 in the bank. And around us were a group of housing estates all in a mess with 55 languages and dialects spoken within 10 minutes walk of our buildings, quite a lot of racial tension, and anyone who could get out had got out. So it was a mess.
Have you always been a positive person? Because most people would kind of arrive there and think, if I could just talk to the bishop about another church.
Yeah, I'm a fairly positive person, but it seemed to me in those early days there were three choices. Either I could stay in bed every morning and get depressed, which was a real option when I'd met Philip, the head teacher across the road, who was retiring early because it had all become too much for him, and I'm thinking that could be me in 5 years. Or I could hide away in my study and write a doctorate on poverty as a way of avoiding meeting Karen and her children, who lived on the seventh floor of a tower block across the road. Or I could get nosy and loiter with intent, and I'm a Yorkshireman from Bradford, and I think Yorkshire people are nosy, and so loitering with intent was a real option. And I began to loiter around these estates.
I have to ask about the cultural differences because I've spent enough time in England to know that the great thing about Yorkshire people is that if you spend any time with them at all, you will know your faults very well because they'll tell you what they are. I mean, how did that go, the Yorkshiremen in East London?
Well, actually, East Londoners are a bit like that. It's why I like them. They're really straightforward and they tell you how it is. And so we hit it off quite quickly, actually. And to be honest, many of them have been promised endless things by local politicians and none of it worked. So there's quite a lot of apathy, really, and people thought everything was impossible. And suspicion of anyone who suggested anything, for very good reason. I mean, when you got to listen to what had gone on and all these promises that had been made by endless politicians, actually there was good reasons for people to be suspicious initially. And we realised early on you needed to become known by what you did, not by what you talked about.
All right, so your assets were, well, I think you said £400. You had derelict buildings around you.
We had a suite of derelict church buildings. Behind us was a 3-acre derelict park that the kids set on fire every bonfire night.
Right.
And across the road was a sort of lorry park with Alsatian dogs running around it and a school across the road that was one of the most difficult schools, you know, around. So, you know, nothing worked.
Nothing, not promising. What kind of projects did you encourage?
Well, I first began to loiter, and if I'm honest, I came across the traditional charitable sector in Britain at that point, 25 years ago. And to many ways, they just copied the public sector. They had endless management committee meetings. They argued over equal opportunities. They got loads of 1970s liberal ideology. And the religion was, we in the public sector and social sector are good and business are bad. They're greedy capitalist pigs. You know, that was the sort of mindset. Mm. And I quickly began to work out that this religion was unreal, really. And that actually there was lots of ideology, but many of these charities didn't seem to build anything or make any difference. They just reinforced often poverty and a culture of dependence, which seemed to me to be profoundly unhealthy.
What was the first thing you did then?
Well, I began with my 12 people to come to the idea of spotting individuals and backing individuals. So a young woman came with three kids wanting to develop a dance school, and we formed a partnership, a business partnership, and I began to work with her, and I gave her our church hall, but said, I'm not just going to take a bit of rent off you to get my £400 growing. We're going to work together. And we built this dance school together. And of course, within 6 months, bits of the traditional charity sector were jumping up and down and saying, this is terrible. This, you know, woman's going to charge these children. But of course, I realised that East End parents are not stupid. They realised that Janet had run a real, you know, been a dancer, had done the ships and Covent Garden and television, knew about the disciplines necessary to get into the dance business. And by year six, we've got 150 children, a West Indian child's been offered a place in the Royal Ballet, and a whole range of things are happening.
You've already alluded to this, a great deal of opposition to your ideas from bureaucrats.
Yeah,
but one of the keys to your success seems to be that you managed to harness the skills of the local community. You got them to buy in. How did you do that?
Well, when we'd run the dance school, a group of families had been running a nursery in a house down the street, and we came together and built a nursery, basically, with an art gallery and a theatre, and the first integrated nursery in Britain that didn't take 30 kids from the at-risk register and put them in one place, because if you do that, you've got a disaster. We started to put children like that with my own children, whom we paid the going rate. So you began to create a financial model that was sustainable. And once you'd built a nursery, you promised it and you built it, suddenly people began to say, hang on, they made a promise. And here it is. And my children, they did what they said they were going to do. So this isn't just hot air. This is about integrity. It's about doing what you say you're going to do. And that begins to change the nature of a relationship.
On Life Matters today, we are talking about social entrepreneurs with the man who really wrote the book on social entrepreneurship, Andrew Mawson, Lord Andrew Mawson, Lord Andrew Mawson of Bromley by Bow, to give him his full title, who has made a remarkable difference in a community in East London and has greater ambitions, and we will get to those shortly. There is a story I read in your book about you go to the National Health Service, you've got this idea, buy 3 acres of derelict land around the church, build an integrated health centre, and blocked at every turn. And then you get to meet the minister.
Yeah, well, the health project, of course, happened because a woman called Jean Viles was dying of cancer at 35 in appalling circumstances with 2 children, 16 and 2, sleeping in the same bed. And we kept a detailed record of the last 6 months of her life and began to take practical care of her, really. And then there was a senior level inquiry after her death, and it got in the national press. And all these directors of social care at the health service were all going around the table justifying why they'd done or not
done.
That's right. And so it was out of that process that we began to position a new way of thinking about health. And even following Jean's death, we had 18 months of treacle to swim through. Eventually, Dr. Brian Mulwinney, the government minister, appeared on our doorstep. And I showed him round, actually, and began to challenge their traditional way of thinking about equality and fairness and all this ideological goo-gah, really. And he went back, and 2 weeks later, a copy of a letter to the chief executive of the health authority saying, I'm going to back these people, and I want you now to put in place a budget for 3 years, 3 members of staff, and I want it in place in 30 days. And they went mad.
I bet.
Because they said, this is unfair and inequitable, and why should a minister involve themselves locally? You know, but that's what triggered the next stage of the Bromley by Bow Centre, which is now a multi-million pound project. Personal responsibility.
It's a huge success. The thing that impresses me about that story and other things in your story, in this book, it's the courage and the wherewithal to start things and to get people to buy in, but to keep swimming through the treacle.
Yeah.
Because that's the bit that would get me down, I could see.
It has its moments.
The area used to have to bus in social workers and counsellors and teachers and other professionals because they didn't want to live there. But now I think 3/4 of them are involved our locals.
Yeah. You had a whole army of welfare professionals moving in and earning salaries. There was a whole industry on it. Mm. But again, what is the way into these big problems? It's the micro. Business knows this, that you have to understand the detail of what's happening in a place. And you could see that all the money was washing through Bromley by Bow, but actually was making very little difference. Lots of civil servants were ticking boxes, but not watching the long view. And so we have built a situation where actually local people began to develop enterprise skills and employment. And we now have 25 businesses and social enterprises operating in a business centre on the park. One's a landscape business, which has £1 million turnover now.
It's an amazing success story. And because of that, the Blair government really tried to kind of repeat it. But it hasn't been able to, or wasn't able to. What went wrong?
Well, governments, you know, come and look at all these things and they pick up the latest idea, but they never stay with the detail. So they picked up some of our ideas on health and they put a £2 billion project around it, well, about building integrated primary healthcare facilities. Mm. But of course, none of these ministers stay there for 6 months, you know. Civil servants move, come and go. And this stuff is about staying with the devil and the detail. In very poor communities and vulnerable communities, it takes a generation to make real change. It's not about a three-year government programme. And so people, governments come along and pick up bits of things, but never stay with the process. And what Bromley by Bow has begun to do, of course, is challenge some of that internal logic of government, actually. What does democracy mean? Because the Blair administration talked a lot about democracy and delivery. But actually, a lot of those words, when you examine it, were quite confused in many ways. And my sort of view about life is it's about delivery. The way into how you become a citizen is what you do. And actually, you've got to become known by what you do, not by what you talk about. So the projects like Bromley by Bow, I think, have begun to ask serious questions about how does a democracy actually work? How do the words of politicians be turned into reality?
Well, it's actually what you're doing is very challenging to them, isn't it? I mean, it really is, because you want politicians to empower individuals and communities instead of making these promises and painting these pretty pictures with words, actually devolve the power and the responsibility to locals.
Yeah, but in a very practical and entrepreneurial way, in a business-like way. I mean, increasingly, I'm working with some quite large businesses because social entrepreneurs are realising the way into the future is not necessarily partnerships with the public sector, although we obviously work with the public sector, but it's partnership with business and business entrepreneurs because there's real win-win opportunities, and we can talk a bit about that around the Olympics. Mm. And, of course, what we're each seeing as we work more closely together is that large parts of the public sector and the civil service are still profoundly out of date. There's been lots of rhetoric through the Blair administration, a lot of which I agree with, actually. The rhetoric, a lot of it I agree with. But when you look under the surface of the rhetoric, fundamentally, the way that government works and the way that the civil service is operating, nothing's changed. It's still behaving in silos. And business and social entrepreneurs are beginning to actually hit the glass ceiling of that problem.
Well, in Australia now, the new, still newish Kevin Rudd government, ideas and talk about social inclusion. What could this new-ish government learn from your experiences?
Well, obviously, I'm not an expert on Australia. I've only just literally landed in the country. And far be it for me to tell them what they should do. But I do know from experience that you have to learn from the micro and you have to begin to find out around Australia, you know, who are the people who are doing this stuff, who've got a track record, and you have to dump some of the old ideology, really, of equality and fairness and social, all these apple pie words, they're wonderful. You actually have to find who are the people who are going the full nine yards, and you have to begin to back success, really, and create a culture that backs success and that go with... It's not about spreading the jam thinly everywhere so everyone gets a lick and no one gets a meal. It's about building some quality examples of what this actually means.
So finding some excellence and kind of backing... And that brings me, of course, to Noel Pearson, whom you've known for several years, he's clearly very inspired by your work.
Yeah.
How could your kind of social entrepreneurship work in Aboriginal communities?
Well, I've known Noel for a few years, and I've been really impressed by Noel, really, and his grasp of some of this, and we've spoken on platforms together. And I thought it was really strange when we first met a few years ago that here's a person 12,000 miles away from me, living in a very different world, come to very similar conclusions, actually, and challenging all the sort of 1970s liberal rhetoric about race and all that stuff and welfare. And I think he's right. actually. And we've come to many similar conclusions. When I look at where Noel's spending his life, of course, he's spending his life with his community and with a whole range of people and some real practical realities and challenging the theories of policymakers and others who live, I suspect, in Canberra. In our case, they live in Westminster, you know. This is all about the nitty-gritty of life and coming to terms with the reality, in our case, of Karen and her children and what happens on the seventh floor of a tower block, actually, with endless bits of government coming past your door, patronising you and creating dependency cultures.
Well, that's it. Yeah, I was going to ask about that, because there's been a lot of talk here in Australia about welfare dependency, particularly in relation to the Indigenous communities. Mm-hmm. Has that been a big obstacle in turning things around in East London?
When I first went to East London, 97% of all the money running through our communities was from the state. It was absolute dependency, you know, and we were investing in poverty, millions of pounds, nothing changed. And it was as we then set up eventually a £300 million housing company that began to take control of some of the housing and began to create a situation where people could own their own houses or shared ownership. So there were pathways into owning assets and taking responsibility for things to change the culture. Because the state had created a sort of impossible situation for human beings, really, of total dependency. Mm.
Well, you're now working on a project called Water City, part of the preparations for the London Olympics. What do you hope will be achieved? Because this is a big, big, ambitious idea, isn't it?
It is. Well, Richard Rogers, the architect and myself, and a few of us, wrote probably the first document 12 years ago suggesting why the Olympics should come to East London, the Lower Lee Valley, literally across the road from our site, really. Yeah. And if you fly into London City Airport and look down, all you see is water. Mm. And you see the Limehouse Yacht Marina, you see Canary Wharf surrounded by water, the O2 concert facility, the XL conference facility, 5.5 miles of waterways going north up around the Olympic site. Water has driven the economy of East London for 2,000 years, back to the Romans. And what we were beginning to say is, look, guys, it's time once again for water to drive the economy. But this is about, as we build houses down the canals, they lift land values by 20%. If you began to connect the water to people's lives, suddenly East London, instead of being a bit of a dump, can become a new, beautiful metropolitan district of London, actually. And if we call it Water City, you'll understand what that's about in China in 3 seconds. And so we've begun to sort of develop this whole piece. And of course, we now own 8,500 units of housing on an area of land the same size as the Olympic site, across the road from the Olympic site. So we own a lot of land and assets now. And so we're in a position with some of our partners in business to begin to try and lift the game. And social entrepreneurs and business now are beginning to get into the building of pieces of city, which is moving some of this stuff to quite a scale. And obviously the Olympics has the opportunity to catalyse that to another stage.
It could be a missed opportunity too, though.
It could be a missed opportunity.
I know that earlier this year you used a House of Lords debate to describe the regeneration structures in East London as a mess.
Yeah.
And you want the decision-making to be simplified. Yeah. Because, I mean, it's easy to imagine a scenario where the developers put up some very profitable but not very nice buildings and make a fortune, and social entrepreneurship doesn't get to happen.
Yeah. We could be, or we could be held back by the 40 government public bodies and committees that have been created down the Lower Lee Valley that are just producing minutes and strategy documents when we need an entrepreneurial culture. What we've just created is a new company, a social enterprise called Water City Developments, and we've created it with business. And this has an asset lot within it, so that all the private developments we do, all the profits that come into the Water City company will then be locked into the Lower Lee Valley. They won't go into any individual's pocket, and they will have to be reinvested in communities and people and the people in the Lower Lee Valley. So business will make a profit from what they do, but any profits we make will get reinvested down in those communities in East London. So, again, social enterprise is moving to another stage, and we've created this vehicle just very recently, actually, to begin to do this in another way.
Good luck with it, and thank you very much for joining us today. It's been a pleasure to meet you and to hear about your work.
You.
Lord Andrew Mawson of Bromley by Bow is the author of The Social Entrepreneur, Making Communities Work. It's published by Penguin Australia, and he's doing an extensive tour of Australia at the moment. If you'd like more information, we've got links on the website, abc.net.au/rn/lifematters. Fabulous food for thought, I think, in what he's had to say. So love to hear your thoughts on that. You can do that on the website. Jump on the guest book, send us an email. Now, coming up next, I think, hold on to your seats, stuff that white people like.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.